TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Bill McKibben on Deep Economy. A talk and conversation with Michael Pollan. This is the second part of a lively exchange between Bill McKibben and his fellow author, Michael Pollan, on Bill McKibben's most recent book, Deep Economy. McKibben says, "For the first time in human history, more is no longer synonymous with better. Indeed, for many of us, they have become almost opposites. I want us to think in new ways about the things we buy, the food we eat, and the energy we use." End quote. McKibben is credited with having written the first book on climate change in 1989. It is entitled The End of Nature. At the end of part one of this conversation, McKibben said that future generations would name not 9/11, but Hurricane Katrina as the defining moment in modern history, for what it began to reveal about the real position of human beings in relation to the natural world. Here is Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and professor of journalism at UC Berkeley, picking up that reference to Katrina.
I think you're absolutely right about Katrina. I think there is a sea change going on, and Al Gore's movie, too, was all part of this. And you feel the kind of ice cracking around this issue, which must be incredibly gratifying to you after, you know, you've been writing about it since 89, I think, and when we really didn't know this term, climate change. But if you look at where this political energy and even economic energy is being channeled, the big word out of Washington and now out of Silicon Valley and everywhere is ethanol. Essentially, everyone has kind of battened on that as a key. And when you think about, well, why should that be? It's very hard to think of a powerful interest that isn't challenged in any way by ethanol. Indeed, most of them are gratified. It's basically, let's take that liquid we were putting in our gas tanks and we'll switch to this other liquid. But this will allow us to make change without really changing anything about the way we live. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. You don't address it exactly in the book.
You're sort of the one to talk about it because you've written the definitive history of our sort of abuse of corn. And there's something just perfectly, wonderfully fitting that after, two decades of using it as corn syrup to sort of destroy our health, we're now determined to use it.
Well, we can't possibly eat anymore. That's why we have to feed it to our cars.
And this is, when I talk about farce, and farce bordering on tragedy, ethanol from corn is the perfect example. You can feed a person for a year on the amount of corn that it takes to fill the gas tank of an SUV one time. And don't think that people around the rest of the world aren't going to notice this. They already are. There were people rioting in Mexico City because the price of tortillas had doubled. Well, corn's a pretty fungible commodity, and that's we put all their farmers out of business with NAFTA, as you've documented powerfully, and now we're not even going to grow the corn we're going to use the corn for Ford Explorers instead of tortillas.
Well, what happens is once you link your agricultural economy to ours through moving toward an export model and an import model, you're really vulnerable to whatever happens in Washington. And the word went down from President Bush, the State of the Union address before this, that ethanol was the way. And suddenly people in Mexico are paying the price.
Absolutely.
And we do risk a situation where agricultural lands and other lands are devastated around the world to keep our SUVs going. And that's true, I think, even for cellulosic ethanol, which sounded like a much better idea. But
one of the things about technology and global warming is that, people are forever searching for some silver bullet that's going to solve this problem. And ethanol was the one for the... There are none. We already had our magic fuel. Coal, gas, and oil were magic. You know, they're unbelievable. You scrape a couple of feet of soil off the ground, and there you've got all this coal, and or you know, you stick a drill in the ground, and oil comes under its own pressure, comes, and it's filled with BTUs, and it's compact, and it's easy to transport, and easy to refine, and it catches fire almost on its own. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. There's nothing like that in the pipeline. There's no silver bullet. There may be enough silver buckshot sort of scattered around that if we were really careful about conserving energy and not wasting it, that we'd begin to be able to find the sort of amounts that we need to carry on, especially if we could sort of change a little bit the idea of what carrying on meant. But at the moment, we're trying to ram things through our existing models. But ethanol, I mean, the bloom is off ethanol after about a year. I mean, people have figured out that it's a ridiculous scam, and it's only going to be Cargill and ADM that are pursuing it. Cellulosic ethanol may work to some degree in marginal land with places where you don't have to use a lot of inputs to grow it. But, I mean, all the low-hanging fruit is in conservation, and that we don't immediately make that the number one priority is just economic craziness.
And of course, the problem with conservation and the reason that there's so much investment flowing. I was at a conference in Silicon Valley, and all the talk among the venture capitalists and the investment bankers down there is alternative fuels because they see an opportunity to make money. And but it's very hard to see a way to make money through conservation. And really, you know, the motive force in our society is, well, let's find a new product to fix the problems created by the old product.
Almost everything that we should be doing, we're not doing because precisely someone says this will interfere with economic growth. It will slow economic growth. Why can't we start cutting carbon emissions, says the Bush administration? Because that would interfere with economic growth. Why do we have to keep cutting taxes on rich people? Because it's necessary to spur economic growth. I mean, every dubious idea, this is the reason that we come up with. As long as that remains the only thing we can think about, it's going to be very hard to get out of it, which is why, interestingly, economists are going to be such an important part of whatever happens next. At the moment, it's a kind of priesthood, united around sort of working on this one goal. How do we get more, But its sets of tools and habits of thought would allow it, if it took a sort of different set of ideas, to be enormously powerful in figuring out how we might build all kinds of other systems that balanced other goals. You could just as easily take human satisfaction as the goal for whatever it was you wanted to do and say that's how we're going to decide. Or you could take ecological durability as your goal. Or you could figure out some way to balance the three of these in some real way. You can almost sense it beginning to happen. There are a few countries around the world that are starting to try to measure quality, produce quality of life indices as a kind of supplement to their GDP things. That's really important because, what we measure actually turns out to be what we work on. At the moment, the only number we've got is gross national product, and as the late, great Ed Abbey once remarked, boy, is it gross. The Economist magazine, that left-wing rag, started printing a couple of years ago trying to calculate where quality of life is the highest, in the countries that they surveyed. And they were looking at developed countries. And bizarrely, no matter sort of how often they did the thing, the United States kept coming in at the very bottom of this list, of developed countries in all sorts of ways. I mean, no matter what sort of indices people were looking at, they turned out we didn't do very well. Life expectancy, morbidity, satisfaction with life, educational attainment, on and on and on. The place we were really good at was, consumption. We had a lot of stuff. I mean, it was quite powerful to see that they were forced to conclude that this wasn't working all that well. I don't know. I mean, what's your sense when you travel around the world? Do you think the rest of the world is still looking at us as the only possible model, or beginning to grow a little kind of restive with the idea that...
Well, I think George Bush has done something for the popularity of the U.S. model. It's perhaps one of his more constructive contributions. I think your point, though, is, I mean, it's a cultural product, a project of changing what's glamorous. And we have, for various reasons, glamorized consumption stuff, really good cars. And you suggest, too, that, you know, that kind of prestige could attach to bicycles the way it now attaches to cars. It's a function of glamour, which is in large part a function of advertising in our culture. It's possible to glamorize other things. I mean, something that's happened, we were talking about at lunch, in this culture is that the relative prestige of farming as an occupation, which was just at the bottom for many years. I mean, farmers are who you made fun of. It was absolutely acceptable from about 1900 on to make fun of, you know, the rubes in the country. And there was a concerted effort to eliminate, to shrink the number of farmers for various reasons. It's a tremendous cultural undertaking.
What do you think? I mean, do you think farmers markets, which are growing fast now, do you think that's going to keep going, or is it just the moment of...
No, I think, well, there's some countervailing pressures, but, I mean, it's interesting that you fix on food as part of this, because it seems to me it is a leading indicator, and it is a place, and Wendell Berry does as well, actually, that where you see the stirrings of local economies for a lot of reasons. One is, it's easy to do it there. It's very easy for all of us to make that kind of change in our lives. And that's not to say it's a trivial thing. I think it's a very profound thing. But I see signs that it's growing. I was kind of shocked to see this issue of Time magazine, of all things, forget organic, eat local. You know, organic hadn't even really gotten established in the culture, and we've already transcended
it. They're past that, yeah.
And you find really vital local food economies popping up everywhere. And as you say, it's the fastest growing corner of the food industry. We have no idea how big it is because there's a lot of taxes not being paid at farmers markets, so no one's really counting. But in a way, it's very much like the food economy of the Soviet Union near the end, which is the fact that everybody checked out on the approved ways to get your food and pay for it and pay taxes on it, and it was an underground economy that by the end was 50% of the food economy of the Soviet Union.
What I think is so interesting is that, you know, we have these very determined ideas about how inevitable it is that economies are going to work in certain ways and sort of human nature and things, whatever. We almost sort of reject out of hand the idea that even when we can see the exceptions in front of their eyes, like, you know, I've been several times in the last few days in public radio stations in different parts of the country, and people say, well, but is this really realistic, you know? And I always say to the guy, like, look at the business model that your public radio station operates under. I mean, here's a really dumb business model. Let's give away what we have, you know, for free, and then twice a year, like, hector everyone to send in a check, you know? That'll work really well, you know? But in fact, it works great, and that's the fastest growing part of the broadcast spectrum is community and public radio, because people value the product, and they value the... One of the truly weird... I mean, this really is weird. One of the interesting statistics is that listenership actually tends to go up on radio stations, public radio stations, during the pledge drive. Because people, I think, sort of get off on the whole, like, the community's holding and it's working and everybody's chipping in kind of thing.
I can think of other interpretations for that. Where was I going? Do you have a question? I think we should take some audience questions.
Yes, I think that's good
idea. We're at that moment. Do you have the audience questions?
Bill? Jim Hansen says we have 10 years to turn increasing carbon emissions to decreasing, yet all we get in U.S. as solution is cap and trade or offsets, which most of the rest of the world considers to be a shell game or eco-imperialism. What suggested solutions do you have?
Jim Hansen is the great NASA climatologist, who in fact was up on Capitol Hill today testifying. And he said last year, after the Bush administration tried to stop him from making the speech, said that we had 10 years left to do something. That was a year ago, so now we have 9 years left. which isn't very long. I mean, 9 years is 2 presidential elections. It's 4 congressional election cycles. I mean, it's, and considering the momentum of the system, our carbon output in this country continues to increase slightly better than 1% a year, year after year after year. It's going to be a tall order. The reason that we're talking about legislative target of 80% by 2050, which is sort of Hansen's number, but it's not based on, you know, on some calculation that says 75% wouldn't be enough and 83% would be too much. It's an effort to say we need a target that demands sharp, dramatic, rapid, ambitious action, something to deliver a strong enough shock to the system of the sort of economic expectation that it would change how people make investment decisions and that sort of thing in the near term. In the next 5 or 10 years, the way to achieve rapid reductions in this country is through conservation. And the good news is about the fact that we're such energy hogs is that it should be relatively easy. I mean, there is unbelievable amount. I mean, if all we did was just convert our automobile fleet over 10 years into hybrid cars, we'd meet the first part of that 80% by 2050 goal. You know, there's so much waste. What's amazing is to look at the Europeans, who, as I told you, have used half as much energy as we do, and they're busy now, busier than we are, pursuing 60 and 80% reductions. They're actually having to work at it now. I mean, they're starting to cut into muscle, and it's harder. They're really having to make tough decisions. You know, a politician would be well advised to hop on this right now, because the first 10 years are going to be relatively easy. I mean, that's how much waste there is in this system.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up? To what extent do you think that consumers can build these local economies that you're talking about, and to what extent would you need public action?
I think that the beginnings of them come from people working with their neighbors to build things. That's where farmers markets tend to come from and things. But to take them, to scale them up, you know, to sort of ramp it all up, is really a place where I think we need public investment. And I think, you know, for instance, in Vermont, where I live, we're working hard to convince the state legislature to stop trying to subsidize the endless decline of the dairy industry and to start spending some of that money to build slaughterhouses, to build food canneries and preserving facilities and things like that. You all have it extremely easy here in the Bay Area. Part of this book I describe doing spending the whole winter with my family eating only what came from the Champlain Valley. And it's a little harder in, you know, a place with a 3-month growing season than it is around here, but still entirely possible, and it'd be much easier.
Will you talk about how you did that? Because I'm often asked this question. Well, you know, how am I going to get my salad in February?
Well, we redefined salad.
Tell us. We want a recipe.
We got real good at, you know, I made all these great beet slaws and things, and, you know, cabbages you can keep a long time. And we had, we had a lot of potato salad. People sort of look at you as if you said, and then I, you know, held my breath for 6 months or something. I mean, it's worth remembering that everybody on Earth until 50 years ago essentially ate locally, and 90% of people on Earth still do eat locally. So it's really not the most unbelievable trick to pull it off, you know, in the sense of things.
Have you attempted to include the measure of spiritual attainment in your economic modeling, especially concerning satisfaction? How does that fit into our effort in reversing climate change?
This is actually a very important question, and one of the 2 or 3 best things that's happened in the last couple of years in the environmental movement is the sudden emergence of a religious, spiritually based environmental movement. In fact, On Friday, I was in Northampton, Massachusetts, to give the sermon as this interfaith climate rescue march set off on a 10-day trek across Massachusetts. Buddhists and Muslims and Christians of all kinds and Jews, and it was very powerful and impressive. What's really important about faith communities of all kinds and faith traditions of all kinds is they are the last real organizations in our society that can even begin to posit some reason other than accumulation for human existence. You know, our government has clearly given up on this. It's the economy, stupid. And our higher education institutions basically take their job as churning out people to fit the dictates of the economy, whatever it is. There remains, though it isn't as brought to the fore as often as it should, a real countercultural possibility in religious traditions. And if that can be mobilized, I think it'll play in. I got to tell you, one of the things that changed the global warming debate, began to change it a lot in this country and on Capitol Hill, was this statement from evangelical churches last year, evangelical leaders, that, and this was the first issue on which they broke with Bush and the Republican orthodoxy, and it was a very powerful statement in defense of the created world, the natural world. And it's a place where we need very much to break down walls instead of putting them up and find ways to work with people. And I've spent a lot of time in evangelical churches in the last year. And one of the things I keep saying there is, look, we may have some differences of opinion about how this began, you know, creation and evolution. Those are interesting and whatever. But at some level, they're not very significant. What is significant is that we're busy collaborating on the decreation of the planet as we speak, and that's something we can do something about. And they really stand up to that challenge and are beginning to climb aboard, and it's a very powerful possibility.
Both of you make statements to the degree, quote-unquote, oil is the lifeblood of industrial agriculture. Have you seen any positive changes in the industrial sector, or just have anything else to say?
Be careful. Last year, the price of natural gas, which is the feedstock for fertilizer, for industrial fertilizer, spiked very, very high. And lo and behold, farmers were a little more careful about using it. Right now, farmers use about twice as much fertilizer as their crops need. And if you ask them why, they'll tell you, well, it's crop insurance. I'd rather err on the side of too much rather than too little, with the result that it runs off into the rivers and poisons the water table. So in a way, it's another externalized cost. When that fossil fuel is not so cheap, or when we're paying the real price of it, and of course the real price of the fossil fuel are wars in the Middle East, the military budget, I mean, all these things are not calculated into the price of gasoline or fertilizer. I think that industrial agriculture would be a lot more careful with it. But in general, when you ask this question, you know, can we really go down this path? Can organic feed the world? As Bill says about development, well, it'll have to, because we won't have that fossil fuel energy, and we will figure out ways to do it. And one of Bill's, you know, great turns in this book was to go to Cuba and see, well, here's what happens when you don't have fossil fuel for your agriculture. There is a way to do it, and the Cubans figured it out. You want to talk a little bit about that?
She said we could just say more.
Yes, no. It was incredibly interesting because, I mean, this is the one place in the world that went through peak oil, you know, because their whole ridiculous economic arrangement broke down. You know, their whole thing was we'll sell sugar at 3 times the world price to the Soviet Union, which sort of liked having a tropical version of Leninism, you know, down in Cuba. And the minute that the Russians, you know, suddenly the Russians were not interested in that anymore, and the ships start coming. I mean, Cuba was like a moon base that had no shuttles arriving anymore. People went from having 3,000 calories a day to having 1,700 calories a day in the course of a year. That gets your attention, you know, pretty fast. And everyone expected them to just collapse. In fact, there was a story in the front of the New York Times Magazine, last days of Castro's Cuba. I mean, and they also couldn't get pesticides or fertilizer because of our embargo. So that basically, they had to build an organic agriculture, de facto organic agriculture. They started opening up their markets, some, you know, establishing farmers' markets and things in the place of the unproductive, you know, rigid system that they'd had. But mostly, they started farming every square inch of urban land, and they put lots of people on the farm, and it became a very high prestige job. Farmer in Havana makes more money than a doctor does now. And they got good at it. They're back to 3,000 calories a day. One of the things it did leave me with is a kind of some confidence that whatever else happens, we may not starve, you know. People will figure out how to do this.
That was Bill McKibben in conversation with Michael Pollan at an event hosted by Global Exchange in Berkeley, California, in March 2007. Bill McKibben had just completed his most recent book, Deep Economy. His best-known book on climate change is The End of Nature. Subsequent books include Hope, Human and Wild, about Curitiba, Brazil, and Kerala, India, examples of people living more lightly on the earth, and Enough, about the existential dangers of genetic engineering. McKibben and his family live in Vermont. He's a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Michael Pollan is the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and The Botany of Desire. He's professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.